Welcome to Statewide. Ahead, we hear from an outgoing state lawmaker who talks about the Me Too movement and what she says needs to happen to improve the statehouse environment for women.
A lot of it is in the policy and the laws, and then some of it is trying to change behaviors and have respect and kindness toward other human beings. And how do you legislate that?
Republican Sarah Wojcicki Jimenez joins us. I'm Sean Crawford. Also ahead this hour, the issue of pesticides is going from farm fields to courtrooms. There's an effort underway that could allow pharmacists in Illinois to provide birth control without a doctor's note. We'll tell you about the connections among some animal shelters that help them get more pets into homes. And a report from a huge motorcycle rally. That and more coming up on Statewide. Stay with us. Welcome to Statewide, where we hear reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. There's plenty ahead for today's show. There's a push in Illinois to make it easier to get birth control medication. It wouldn't even require a doctor to sign off. We'll hear more about that. And also a political story that sounds like something out of a John Grisham novel. All coming up on Statewide. First up today, by the end of her tenure this year, State Representative Sarah Wojcicki Jimenez, a Republican from Leland Grove, will have only served 3 years in the state legislature. But a lot has happened during that relatively short time. Reporter Jacqueline Driscoll sat down with the lawmaker to discuss the future of women in politics.
Since you announced you were not going to be seeking re-election about a year ago, you've probably had some time to reflect on your time as a state representative. What are some of your proudest accomplishments throughout your time in the legislature?
Probably the thing that will be the most memorable was when we voted to end the budget impasse. So having a budget impasse for a couple of years as the representative of the capital city was very difficult. Whether I was in church, the grocery store, dropping my kids off, everywhere I went when we didn't have that budget, I was hearing stories around the community of what kind of challenge it was or how it was hurting the different people that I served. And so when we had the opportunity to vote for a budget that was balanced, even though it had a revenue increase, which is politically something that people don't do, it was one of those moments where I thought, when I push this button, I know that it's the right thing to do. I understood why some people pushed the red button because of who they represented or what they were working on. But for me, I knew that it was going to bring some stability back to my community. And it was something that was a necessary thing that we had to do, that we had just gotten in this spiral that was unresolvable. But I also knew that by making that vote, it was a vote that many of the people in my party, they were not supportive of. The governor was very upset by it. It was one of those votes you take where you knew that you had to do it, that it was the right thing to do. But politically, you were going to have some major challenges in the weeks and months ahead.
Something that really gained traction, essentially it was created during your time in office, was the Me Too movement. We saw this gain traction throughout the entire country, right here in Illinois. It became evident that there was a certain culture throughout the state house that wasn't particularly inviting to women. So can you talk a little bit about that culture? And have you seen it improve or change in your time as a representative?
I think it was last fall, so coming up about a year, there was new information to many of the members that we didn't have a legislative inspector general for our branch of government for almost 3 years, which shame on all of us for not knowing that, not feeling that. And there was a lot of miscommunication, non-information, that there weren't cases, on and on and on. But the bottom line is that was ridiculous that we wouldn't have somebody in that role. And so fast forward to now, you know, there have been allegations that have come out almost monthly involving folks in and around state government. Some people have resigned. There are other investigations at the Legislative Inspector General's office. And part of it for me, and I've worked in and around the Capitol as a reporter, on staff, now as a legislator, and I have experienced cases where I feel like it was inappropriate comments. Now that we've studied the law and know how to define sexual harassment in a legal sense, I don't think that any of those situational, inappropriate comments to me were pervasive. And, you know, if I ignored the person or mentioned something to a supervisor, it stopped. So it wasn't this pattern that you have to prove legally as a definition for sexual harassment. Now, should women have to experience that at all? The answer is no. For me, I've kind of had to deal with a lot of things in my career, from what I described as sort of inappropriate talking to a woman that wouldn't raise probably to the definition of sexual harassment, to a stalking case when I was a reporter in East Central Illinois that went through the county courthouse. And so I think I have sort of a unique perspective on something that was a felony charge to inappropriate. And so what we've been doing at the State House is trying to study our laws and see how we can strengthen them, strengthen our process, make it more transparent, but still confidential. A lot of it is in the policy and the laws, and then some of it is trying to change behaviors and have respect and kindness toward other human beings. And how do you legislate that?
You're listening to Statewide, and I'm speaking with Representative Wojcicki Jimenez about her time in state government. Staying on the topic of Me Too and women's equality, you mentioned that you had some inappropriate remarks made to you. Did you ever feel that that inappropriateness was ever a hindrance on your time as a legislator?
I think as I came into the position of legislator, and I think this is an interesting point that you make, when you are the person in power, if you're a woman or a man, those types of things go away, because I think people are hesitant, because you're a person, generally, when they're meeting with you, they're asking you for something. The things that I described in terms of inappropriate comments and those sorts of things pretty much stopped when I became a legislator. Now, there were some things that happened on the campaign where people were very inappropriate, commenting about what I look, different parts of my body, you know, things that I would do or not do, and those sorts of things, and commentary on social media. But again, that's not really, when we're talking about sexual harassment, that's not a workplace thing. And so this is where things get a little hairy in terms of free speech and what people can say. Yes, it's inappropriate, but I think that for the most part, it wasn't ever a situation where somebody said, can you do this for this or anything to that, not even close. As we're talking about this issue, you see more sexual harassment and allegations of it, where there is a really big imbalance of power. And so you have elected people, they control budgets, they control bills, they control all these things. And then other people who are coming to talk with them, they all have a role and it's very important, but the power imbalance is so great. These are the places where people are the most vulnerable for this type of behavior.
With all of these issues, all of these stories coming out at the State House, it can be probably very intimidating for some women. So how do we get women interested? How do we get them to run?
Women, I think, make up slightly more than 50% of the population nationwide. And it just makes sense that your legislative body should match that. Now, in Illinois, it's around 30%, I think, so, which is still very low, but I think we rank in the top 10 of legislatures across the country. So that's better, I guess. But we certainly should strive and have it be a goal to have more women involved in politics and in government at all levels. I think for me, and this is just kind of a funny thing, but being a younger woman legislature with kids who are 5, I really don't have time for a lot of, I want to say, kind of like BS. I want to we have a job to do. Let's get it done. What do we need to get it done? And I think one of the things that I've learned, especially in a role in the legislature, is that most things are negotiable. When you come into these roles, you have to pick really 1 or 2, 3 at the most, things that are of value for you, maybe a moral issue or personal value. And those are not negotiable. Everything else, you need to learn how to negotiate on. And I think with women sometimes, I guess I can only speak for myself and the friends that I know, but you see the goal and how are we going to get there by the end of the day? And we don't really have time to dig in our heels and wait forever to get this done. And so I think by having more women at the table, it would help maybe move some things along.
As two women sitting here, I think we could agree. But given the current political climate, how can parties retain female legislators?
I think that the way that you get women involved is it has to be a little bit different than maybe the traditional way of getting people involved in politics. Because part of the traditional way is that you volunteer on a campaign, you sort of get interested, and maybe you run for a local office, and then you rise, and then... But now we're in an era where political experience and government experience is actually can be a mark against you. You know, we're sort of in this era where that type of route has not been getting people elected. It's actually been something that's been used against you. Oh, you're a career politician. You're a, you know, this, that, or the other. And so I think it leaves an opening for getting other types of people involved. I think what drives women a lot of times is not that they want to be president or the mayor or somebody on the city council. What usually drives women is an issue. And it doesn't have to just be, because some people say, you know, it has to be like kid oriented. It can be any issue. That's kind of the entree for women, is to figure out what maybe they're passionate about and have that be the driver. I think the other thing is you just look at the legislature. I think there's one other lady in my caucus who has a young child, and then me. But I can name several young men who are my age who have young children. And I don't know if it's how we're wired or what, but women sometimes miss this window where they wait till their kids are grown, even though they're in college, and then they run. Well, then you have all these men who've been serving for 10, 15 years, who have more seniority, more leadership, more experience. And so we have to figure out a way to get women interested and be accommodating during that time where a lot of them have young children. Getting some women involved, not only as the person, as the elected person, which is the ultimate goal, but getting them involved in campaigns. And just last week, I had a group of interns in from somebody else's office, and they were wanting a tour of the Capitol, and we were on the floor, and there was one young lady in the group. And I always, and hopefully it doesn't embarrass them, but I point them out, and I say, thank you very much for coming. I know that sometimes it's awkward when you walk in the room and you're the only woman there. And so we need you to keep doing that, especially as young women. Because then I think once they get involved at a younger age, they see it's something they can do.
That's State Representative Sarah Wojcicki-Jimenez. More of our interview with her available at nprillinois.org. Getting birth control in Illinois could one day mean not having to visit a doctor's office. That's already the reality in some states where pharmacists can prescribe it. Lawmakers considered a similar model earlier this year. Not many of them were convinced. For Illinois Issues, Daisy Contreras has more.
For some users of hormonal contraceptives, getting into a doctor's office to receive a prescription can take weeks, and in some instances, even months.
I have seen many women over the years of practice who have an unplanned pregnancy, and it's often because their prescription ran out and they weren't able to get a new one without a long wait.
That's Maura Quinlan, a Chicago-based obstetrician-gynecologist. She says other women use birth control beyond family planning for issues like polycystic ovary syndrome and debilitating menstrual cramps. In most of these cases, she says, an invasive evaluation isn't always needed.
My specialty has made it clear that it is not medically necessary to have a routine pelvic exam before starting contraception.
Five states, including California and Oregon, already allow their pharmacists to prescribe hormonal birth control. Several others are weighing similar legislation. Sally Raffi is a pharmacist based in California, where the law passed in 2016. She says pharmacies decide if they want to offer the service.
The way I think about it is it all comes down to patient access. It's all about having different options for women so they can choose what works best for them.
In Illinois, that's exactly what State Representative Michelle Musman, a Schaumburg Democrat, says she wants to offer.
Access is an issue in rural communities, in urban communities. Lack of transportation, lack of insurance can be a huge problem.
Her proposal would have the state's Department of Public Health provide pharmacies with what's known as a standing order. This is the same tool allowing pharmacists to give patients vaccines without having to step inside a physician's office.
Pharmacists would voluntarily go and have enhanced training to be able to have better understanding of how to dispense this more authoritatively.
But not everyone is convinced about the approach. Musman's measure did not receive enough votes during the spring legislative session. Some lawmakers had concerns about safety and costs, and for others, there was confusion about who is actually filling the prescription. The California law, for example, gives pharmacists full prescribing power. That means their name is on the prescription. They don't depend on a standing order like the Illinois proposal outlines, but those are just the technicalities. In both scenarios, a patient would still meet one-on-one with a trained pharmacist for a consultation. Patients fill out a risk evaluation where health issues like high blood pressure are disclosed. Musman says all of these steps are outlined and approved by the CDC.
So certainly we've always been concerned about making sure that we were indicating all the safety procedures that were in place.
Still, opponents say they believe risks exist by skipping out on the regular office visit and giving pharmacists too much power. State Representative Tony McCombie, a Savannah Republican, says she worries about the possible side effects if a woman is not properly evaluated.
I really think it's important for young women especially to be seeing a doctor, and I think it just really could open up a huge can of worms.
Sally Raffi, the California pharmacist, says the training she and her colleagues have received prepares them to spot any complications before they happen. The health risk questionnaire used by a pharmacist is the same used by physicians in their offices. Yet, unlike in Illinois, some of California's medical associations have been on board with the idea and supportive of pharmacists filling those prescriptions. The Illinois State Medical Society is the group representing doctors in the state. They say they support increased access to contraceptives, but not so much handing pharmacists full prescribing power. Musman says she plans to continue discussions not just with the Medical Society, but with other groups like the Illinois Insurance Association, who also oppose the measure. These insurance companies would need to cover pharmacists for their one-on-one consultation with a patient.
That's what we're working out now, is we believe that for the most part we've got most of these things addressed. Again, it's just a matter of now getting the bill an opportunity.
Meanwhile, people are finding different ways to increase access. In Illinois and in other states, companies are already offering online access to birth control through telehealth consultations with physicians. But for many, the issue of safety remains when a physician isn't directly involved. Advocates like Maura Quinlan, the Chicago obstetrician-gynecologist, says she wants to help dispel the myths.
It's important to remember that these methods are safe, safer than many other medications we can get over the counter. And as a physician, I know too well that hormonal contraception is safer than being pregnant.
I'm Daisy Contreras.
Coming up, a story of politics and murder statewide continues in a moment. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we'll find out more about concerns over pesticide drift. But up next, it's not often that politics and murder get mixed together outside of fiction. But WBEZ's Illinois politics reporters Tony Arnold and Dave McKinney have a story about a Southwest suburban man charged with murdering his longtime friend, about how his arrest affected a race in this year's high-stakes election, and how it relates to one of the most powerful politicians in Illinois. Tony Arnold starts us off.
Elise Hoffenberg is a school board member for District 105 in Southwest suburban LaGrange, and she was inspired by Bernie Sanders to do something no Democrat had done in 8 years, challenge the most powerful Republican in the Illinois House of Representatives.
I heard the call Bernie sent out after Donald Trump was elected. You know, if you really want to change the landscape of politics, run for office. You know, Samantha Bee put the call out. I was like, heck, here I am. I'm a mom. I'm committed to my community. And, you know, why don't I run?
As she started to put her campaign for state representative together last year, Hoffenberg says she met some colorful characters who were part of the political scene. Some of them have since been fired from Democratic House Speaker Michael Madigan's political organization after being publicly accused of bullying and sexual harassment. And another, Hoffenberg says, would end up dooming her candidacy altogether. That was Michael Pelko, a trader who worked in downtown Chicago. He showed up to a campaign event and told Hoffenberg he lived nearby and he was a Little League coach. And she says he promised her big things.
I can do these amazing things for you. I'm going to, you know, you're going to be a star and I'm going to make you a star. Kind of things of that nature and in that vein.
Hoffenberg says she didn't really believe him, but she was polite. And she says it was actually the first and last time she saw him. But Hoffenberg says come December, Pelko did end up doing one thing that was meant to benefit her campaign. In Illinois, every candidate has to turn in signatures to get on the ballot. And Palco challenged the legitimacy of the petitions of her Democratic primary opponent to try to kick him off the ballot. Hoffenberg says she didn't know Palco was doing this, and she was even more surprised in January when she opened up the newspaper and saw his face. Palco had been charged with murdering his longtime friend, accused of shooting him twice in the head and then leaving the body in a Chicago alley.
You know, I have 3 young children. You know, I really don't live that far from him. So the whole thing just made me feel uncomfortable and unsafe, to be honest with you.
So here's Hoffenberg, who was new to this realm of politics. She's meeting some people she didn't particularly like being around, and the name of a man charged with murder had been on an election form meant to help her.
It really felt like I was riding a roller coaster with a blindfold on. I didn't know what was around the next bend. I knew whatever was going to happen would be unexpected, and it wasn't a comfortable place for me.
A short time later, Hoffenberg dropped out of the race.
I'm Dave McKinney. Michael Palco had not been overly active in politics before he filed his petition challenge against Hoffenberg's Democratic primary opponent. And challenging a candidate's petitions is a sophisticated legal process. The names on Hoffenberg's campaign forms and around Palco's signature were some of the biggest names in House Speaker Michael Madigan's powerful political operation. 2 were the people fired for allegedly bullying or sexually harassing colleagues. So you may be wondering how Palco's name got on this election form in the first place. Well, Stephen Landeck has an answer. Landeck is a Democratic state senator from Bridgeview, and he says Elise Hoffenberg was an ideal candidate. Landeck says the Democratic Party of Illinois wanted to help her out, and Landeck knew of Palco from some of his work around the community.
He looked like a credible, honest person, and given his background, as he seemed to have a business and he had some employees. That's what it was portrayed to us. We don't check everybody.
Landeck says he has no clue about Palco's arrest. He referred Palco's name to the Democratic Party of Illinois as a guy from the district who could be listed on a form to try to kick Hoffenberg's opponent off the ballot. Michael Casper is one of the few attorneys in Chicago to practice election law. He is the attorney for the Illinois Democratic Party, which is chaired by House Speaker Michael Madigan. Casper represents up to 75 candidates in any given election cycle, and in this case, he represented Michael Palco's petition challenge.
I don't recall how he got my name or who referred him to me.
Casper says he didn't know Palco and didn't know about Palco's murder charge until we told him. A spokesman for Madigan says the speaker didn't know Palco either, and that Palco was never involved in Madigan's political organization or the Democratic Party of Illinois. But Michael Dorf says they should have checked Palco out. Dorf is another election law attorney. He represented Barack Obama years ago, and he frequently goes up against Casper, including on this case. Dorf represents Elise Hoffenberg's opponent, Tom Klistic, which means Dorf was defending the signatures Palco and Casper were challenging. Dorf says Palco's name in an election form like this is another embarrassment for the political organization of Speaker Madigan, already under fire for bullying and sexual harassment.
This is the drip, drip, drip that is just wearing away the stone. I can't believe that if they were paying attention that they would have allowed something like this to happen.
Again, here's Michael Casper, the attorney for the Democratic Party of Illinois.
To the extent that Mr. Dorf is saying that this was sanctioned by Speaker Madigan or anyone else at the Democratic Party, I don't have any reason to believe that that's accurate.
Michael Palco has pleaded not guilty to murder charges. He's in Cook County Jail awaiting trial. And Palco also has another criminal case pending for allegedly stealing from a Menards store and then hitting a security guard with his car in the parking lot. And Elise Hoffenberg, who dropped out of the race, said as she looks back on her experience running for office, she realizes now she had on rose-colored glasses.
It went south. Everything went south. A handful of people who I encountered during this process ended up having all kinds of negative things, and I'm sort of happy to be back in my life where, you know, the worst thing that happens is our toilet gets clogged up or our backyard floods.
Hoffenberg says she put herself out there by getting involved in Illinois politics. She says she was naive. I'm Tony Arnold.
And I'm Dave McKinney.
Still ahead this hour, we'll hear about parents' last-ditch efforts to get mental health care for their children. That's coming up on Statewide. now let's check in with Harvest Public Media. From getting rid of weeds and insects in your garden to growing a bumper corn crop, pesticides can help people get the most out of their plants. But Madeline Beck reports there are issues with the chemicals. Sometimes they drift off course. They may cause health problems.
Pesticides aren't just in fields. They're in courtrooms around the U.S. There have been several lawsuits filed over dicamba, which for the last few years has drifted into unwanted territory, killing crops like soybeans and pitting neighbor against neighbor. A case in California alleges the pesticide Roundup causes cancer. And this summer, Ninth Circuit federal judges heard a case against a pesticide used on crops that the Environmental Protection Agency was set to ban because it hurt children's mental development. The agency didn't follow through, which seemingly frustrated Judge Jacqueline Nguyen.
How long can EPA sit on this?
In August, the judges told the EPA it has 60 days to finalize the ban. All of this has some people who live next to crop fields worried.
Yeah, I would be interested if there are issues or health concerns.
That's Laura Wetherell. Her family lives next to a cornfield in Champaign, Illinois, and had the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting put an air sampler outside their house. It's one of six in eastern Illinois to find out which pesticides might be drifting onto houses, playgrounds, and schools. Superintendent Scott Watson agreed to host one at a school in Bismarck, about an hour away from Champaign. He's interested in the results, but says pesticide drift isn't something he usually thinks about.
I grew up out in the country. I mean, I lived around farmers. I worked with farmers and stuff growing up as a kid, so I'm used to it. And you think that when your kids go outside that they're safe, and you hope that stands true, but you just never know.
Some states like California mandate buffer zones for certain pesticides, keeping a distance around schools and waterways. In much of the Midwest, state-mandated buffer zones don't exist. But pesticide labels, which are approved by federal agencies, often do have certain setbacks.
Any pesticide that's being sprayed, it's extremely important to read that label ahead of time.
And Troy Kazire would know. He's with Monsanto in western Illinois. He says there are other things to look for on the label, too. Wind speed, the height from which the pesticide is dropped, and the type of nozzle used to spray.
On a windy day, try to throw a ping pong ball at somebody and it blows away pretty easy. Well, you can toss a basketball right to them. And it's the same concept with spray droplets.
Small droplets or high winds can throw pesticides off course. But if some drifts into a yard, Kazire says it breaks down pretty quickly by design, and small doses are less toxic than chemicals found around the home. But direct exposure is a health concern, which is why large-scale pesticide applicators wear heaps of protective equipment and have to get a license to spray. University of Iowa is a leader in pesticide drift research. Jenna Gibbs, a scientist there, says many of the pesticides notorious for drifting in Iowa either have some EPA-backed evidence of causing cancer or too few health studies to know for sure.
We do know that all of them are pretty irritating compounds. They're irritating to the respiratory system and to the skin and to the eyes.
That's at high enough levels, though. Last spring, she and other researchers put 13 air sensors around Iowa City. All of them found measurable levels of pesticides used in farming, even near downtown. But according to preliminary findings,
we don't feel like they're high enough to be a concern.
This didn't include testing during the summer, when potentially more toxic pesticides used to kill insects are often sprayed from planes. But there are plans to research that in the future. Gibbs uses pesticides on her own farmland and knows the challenges farmers face. And she expects research and technology to lead to better pesticides and possibly robots.
The more we rely on robots and drones, maybe we have some device that can go out and target really, really close and spray only specific areas.
The future is nearly here. Companies are working on a Roundup replacement. Farmers have already started to use less of the newly banned pesticide, and those robots are hitting the fields, testing out pesticide sprayers. Madeline Beck, Harvest Public Media.
Now a story from western Illinois. A county jail there is closed due to a lack of correctional officers, as Jason Parrott tells us more.
The roughly two dozen inmates who were being housed in the Warren County Jail have been relocated to the Mercer County Jail in nearby Aledo. Warren County State's Attorney Andy Doyle says it's always been tough for the county to keep correctional officers on staff.
Basically, we pay $7 less than Knox County. So anytime we get somebody hired, get them trained, they get a little experience, they go to where they can make more money.
Doyle says full staffing would be 10 correctional officers, but the county rarely has more than 6. And one officer resigned at a time when 3 others were out on various types of leave.
It really became a short-term problem that we just did not have enough staff to run the jail.
Doyle says an ideal shift would be 2 correctional officers and a jail administrator. But he says far too often, there is only one officer on duty to oversee as many as 30 inmates. Doyle says 3 correctional officers are on active duty, with 3 others returning from leave soon. He says the goal is to pair them with a few new hires.
And so we're hoping within the next couple weeks to at least bring a portion back and house them in Warren County. But it's all going to depend because it's a constant rotation of people going on vacation or sick or whatever the case is.
Doyle says in the meantime, Warren County will have to transport its inmates to and from the Mercer County Jail for court.
Jason Parrott with that report. This is statewide. Well, when someone wants an animal, they either go to a pet store or their local animal shelter. They both put animals up for adoption, but shelters often work with each other to do much more, as Chase Cavanaugh explains.
If you find a cat or dog wandering around your neighborhood, the first thing you should do is check to see if the animal has any identification. Provided you don't find anything, you should probably take this possible stray to the local Humane Society.
Basically, if you're small and furry and homeless, we will have a place for you here.
That's Michelle Graber, Executive Director of Tails Humane Society in DeKalb. The facility takes in dogs, cats, and some other small animals from the community. Tails also puts other creatures in foster care so that they can be raised and prepared for adoption, as well as spay-neuter services. But Graber says their work isn't limited to DeKalb County, or even Illinois.
We partner with some really great shelters in Southern Illinois, Memphis Animal Services. There's one in Oklahoma, Mississippi, and Louisiana who we partner with.
Graper says this cooperation is especially important because there tend to be fewer spay-neuter requirements farther south.
There are a lot more dogs down there and a lot of puppies that are at risk for euthanasia, quite honestly. And so we go down there or meet them halfway and we'll take in animals. And they go to foster homes for a good couple of weeks, minimum of 2 weeks, sometimes longer. And then they come here and they're adopted when they're ready.
The Oklahoma partnership is with the Humane Society of Cherokee County, which is near Tahlequah. Transport coordinator Alexis Colvard said the relationship came from other partnerships in Northern Illinois.
It was a man named Lou Hayes that was doing transports, and he made some connections with Tails, with people that have moved on to other shelters in the Chicago DeKalb area.
The shelter transports dogs to Tails in DeKalb and Paws Humane Society in Chicago. Cherokee transports the animals north, often to a halfway point, such as Tennessee or St. Louis. Then, the Illinois shelters take the dogs into their care. Colvard says Cherokee has partnered with Tails for at least 5 years, and many canines have already made the trip up north.
We transported 898 out last year in a total of 17 trips, and we've already transported out 496 this year in 13 trips.
One thing that makes this possible, according to Colvard, is Tails fostering out animals.
Thanks to Tails and the foster people that sign up to take care of these dogs, we're getting more dogs out of here than we could have imagined. They're not just limited to moms and puppies. They also take strays and abandons and owner surrenders that we can't physically or financially take in down here.
Unfortunately, Graper with Tails says felines don't benefit from a similar system.
Animal controls are not legally obligated to take in cats, but they must take in every dog. So it is much easier to for those dogs to be picked up or taken in animal controls.
Tails limits itself to taking in cats in its immediate area due to sheer volume. But other Northern Illinois shelters are helping in different ways. Stephanie Lauer is shelter manager with Noah's Ark Animal Sanctuary in Rockford. She says her shelter takes in cats from other locations, including Winnebago County itself, for fostering.
The foster coordinator there will call us and let us know. And then usually we pull anywhere from 20 to 24 cats a month, probably average over the year about 10 a month.
Many of these animals are kittens, and Laura says finding foster homes is important, since cats need to be at least 8 weeks old in Illinois before they can be put up for adoption.
So if people are bringing kittens in it when they're taking them away from their mothers outside, and they're only 4 weeks, someone has to care for those kittens for 4 weeks or more in order to get those kittens even to an age where they can be adopted out.
Once they're of age, she says promotion is a simple affair.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And everybody wants a kitten.
I'm Chase Cavanaugh.
There's still more to come here on Statewide. Stay with us. Still ahead, we'll take you to a large rally of African-American bikers. They visited Springfield recently for their annual gathering, and our Rachel Otwell talked with them. That's coming up on Statewide. Over the past several weeks, we've been traveling the state for our Election 2018 Seeking Solutions forums. We're talking with people about what's happening in their area. We made a stop in Moline recently. The topic was the state's loss of population. Illinois lost the most residents of any state last year. That continues a trend. Quad Cities resident Bill Bloom raised a point during the forum.
If you look at housing starts in Iowa, and I'm sure you guys are painfully aware of that compared to Illinois, they have a lot more housing starts. The property tax in Illinois are a double whammy on the citizens of Illinois, because not only do they take, do they kind of siphon a little bit of disposable income out of their pocket every year, but also it depresses the value of homes in Illinois. And in many cases, that home may be the largest single asset that that individual owns or that family owns. And so, and then when they go to sell it, it can be kind of shocking about what their home is now worth, as opposed to, you know, if you buy a home in Iowa, it's going to be higher. It's going to be a lot more expensive. But a year from now, you know, it'll appreciate in value, or 2 years from now. In Illinois, you know, we're not sure what's happening there.
On our panel, we had the Quad Cities Chamber of Commerce Director, Greg Aguilar.
I agree. Property taxes are high in Illinois, and that's a problem, especially for our businesses and our citizens. But our corporate tax rate is, it's actually about average when it comes to national. We're at 5.25%. So, it's another balance. We want it all. We want it all to be at low cost to no cost. I get it. I would love that. In an ideal and a perfect world, that's how it would be. But we can't ignore the balance that does exist. Again, a 5.25% corporate tax rate, I think that's, it is right about average, if not a little bit below average.
Census numbers last year showed Illinois dropped from the fifth largest state down to number six. Pennsylvania moved up past us. Illinois lost nearly 34,000 residents. That was the biggest drop of any state. So the issue is real. Now, Greg, you just mentioned, though, there's some positives in the state of Illinois that maybe are getting pushed under the rug a little bit here. What are some of the things when you are trying to recruit business or retain people here, what are some of the things you push to say, hey, this isn't a bad place to be?
You know, first and foremost, we have an incredible workforce. We have nearly 13 million people, 12.8 million people living in Illinois. There's a culture of people here in Illinois who have always shown up to work, and they have developed their children to also show up to work. So we have a solid workforce. 34,000 people leaving the state of Illinois, of course. We want them to stay. We want them to grow. But the GDP continues to grow in Illinois. Property taxes are a major issue. That's one that we cannot ignore. We hear it almost every day around here. It's even challenging for those citizens who might want to retire, but they can't sell their home. And then looking at values on both sides of the river, saying, wow, I could get a bigger house on the Iowa side with less property tax. And then those that have invested in Illinois, as they try to sell it, they can't, because that property tax, it scares people. That is a reality. But when you go to register your car, in Illinois, no matter what your car is worth, it's going to be $121. If you're on the Iowa side, it's going to cost you depending on how much that car is worth. So whatever you saved in property tax values, you're going to have to increase that tax that you're paying on your car. When it comes to income tax, Illinois has a lower income tax rate. Iowa has a higher income tax rate. When it comes to retirement, Illinois does not tax retirement. And we have to be fair, because if we're only looking at property tax values, of course, Illinois, we lose. But if we're looking at the whole picture, I think it ends up being about equal.
That's Greg Aguilar of the Quad Cities Chamber of Commerce. And that was a portion of our recent 2018 election Seeking Solutions Forum, this one held in Moline. There are more of those to come, different topics to discuss. We'll be in Alton on the evening of August 16th, and watch for others in coming weeks. We hope to see you when we visit your town. Children with severe mental illnesses encounter many barriers to treatment, among them a shortage of psychiatric beds and insurance companies that deny coverage. But some parents discover a workaround, and as Christine Herman reports, they can trade custody for treatment.
Jim and Tony Hoy adopted their son Daniel as a toddler. He'd been severely neglected as a baby, starving and left for dead. As Daniel grew up in the North Chicago suburbs, Tony says he started to show signs of mental illness.
He held knives to people's throats. He tried putting his fingers and his tongue in the light sockets. He broke almost every door in the house. At the same time, he's a little boy. He didn't want to be that way. He didn't like being that way.
Daniel began therapy when he was 10, but the violence escalated. He was hospitalized almost a dozen times over 2 years. Doctors said he needed 24/7 residential care. It wasn't safe to bring him home. But Medicaid and private insurance denied coverage.
We were told that we had to pay out of pocket for it.
At least $100,000 a year, which they didn't have. Then, after the 11th hospitalization, the state of Illinois gave Tony an ultimatum.
And basically said, if you bring him home, we're going to charge you with child endangerment for failure to protect your other kids. And if you leave him at the hospital, we'll charge you with neglect.
And that option is a last-ditch workaround to get treatment. If you abandon your child at the hospital, just refuse to pick them up, the Child Welfare Agency steps in to take custody. It's called a lockout. Attorney Robert Farley Jr. says at that point, the state's obligated to pay for their care.
So you get residential services, but then you've given up custody of your child, which is, you know, barbaric. You have to give up your child to get something necessary.
So the Hoys left Daniel at the hospital.
It was the only thing we could do that kept everybody safe.
In 2010, 2 years after giving Daniel up, they sued the state. In a settlement the following year, they regained custody of their 15-year-old son and got the funding for his care. Around the same time, Farley decided to take on the lack of community mental health care on behalf of all Medicaid-eligible children in the state. He filed a class action lawsuit.
Well, there's really great federal laws, but someone's not out there enforcing them.
In the lawsuit, Farley claimed Illinois illegally withheld services from children with severe mental health disorders. A judge earlier this year ruled that the state must make reforms to comply with Medicaid law, which says medically necessary treatment must be covered. But that decision doesn't address another problem. There are 6 state agencies that interact with at-risk children, but they operate in silos. Democratic State Representative Sarah Feigenholtz says this causes many kids to unnecessarily enter state custody through the Department of Children and Family Services, or DCFS.
It's almost like there's a vacuum and the kids are just being sucked into DCFS.
So she worked to get a bill passed in 2014. It orders those agencies to ensure families are never again torn apart like the Hoys. But data obtained by Side Effects shows today in Illinois, 4 families a month trade custody for mental health treatment. Feigenholtz says the fact lockouts still happen shows a lack of commitment.
The question is, shouldn't government be stepping in and doing their job? And they're not. We just want them to do their job.
Well, if law could fix problems, we'd have a different world.
That's BJ Walker, head of DCFS. She says the reasons lockouts happen are complex. A spokesman for the agency said in an email that when they get blamed, it's like when a pitcher comes in at the end of a losing game to save the day and gets tagged with the loss. Heather O'Donnell is a lawyer with Thresholds, a mental health treatment provider in Chicago. She says lockouts can happen anywhere in the country, but the situation is particularly bad in Illinois.
What Illinois needs to put into place is a system that helps these families early on
so that these kids never get hospitalized.
That's what the state is trying to fix now. A plan is due by October to meet the legal settlement. As for Daniel, he's 23. He's been out of residential treatment and stable for 5 years now. He has a 2-year-old daughter, works nights for a shipping company, and says he would not have gotten better without his parents.
Sometimes it's so hard to do it for yourself. It almost helps to know that, well, you know, I'm doing it for myself, but I'm also doing it for my family and for our relationship.
Daniel's mom, Tony, says he has exceeded every goal they set for him.
The kids do need services, but they also need the support of their families. And when they have both, a lot of kids can be a lot more successful.
Tony's thankful that despite losing Daniel while trying to help him, they ultimately made it through intact. Not every family does. And until that changes, Tony says she won't stop speaking out. I'm Christine Herman.
Residents of Springfield would have had to be shut-ins over the past week not to notice the influx of motorcycles in the town. Some 30,000 or so took over the state fairgrounds for the annual National Bikers Roundup. Our Rachel Otwell headed there to find out more.
Just getting into the fairgrounds was a process not for the faint of heart. Vehicles, mostly motorcycles of every make and variety, from the smaller sports bikes to the bigger motor trikes, from Yamahas to the ever-popular Harley-Davidsons, funnel in through a couple different gates where staff take money and give out armbands. My mode of transportation around the grounds was decidedly less cool. My escort for the day, Gino, pulls up on a golf cart.
We'll take you into motorcycle heaven.
Gino's with the Chicago chapter of the Dirty Dozen Motorcycle Club. He helped organize the dozens of vendors who are here with everything from fried Southern food to shirts that say Black Lives Matter and Straight Outta Springfield, a riff on the hit song Straight Outta Compton by N.W.A.
I'm coming straight out of Compton. When something happens in South
the National Bikers Roundup is the largest annual rally of its kind, one organized by African American motorcycle clubs. Started in 1977 with about 50 riders, now it can draw around 30,000. Fairgrounds are an ideal venue, says Gino. While certain areas are jam-packed with tents and RVs, there's still space to spare. Attendees take in entertainment and a car and bike show. Gino and many others here go by their club nicknames. He says he started riding back in the 70s.
Well, it started in school. We have the training classes through the Illinois Secretary of State.
What appeals to you with the motorcycle lifestyle?
Freedom. This is a wonderful life. I mean, it's no different than if you belong to a block club or a knitting club or any type of association.
Gino talks about the charity work of his motorcycle club, a common activity for such groups.
We have food giveaways. We have a back-to-school book bag. We have a ride we do every year, Toys in the Hood. November, we start collecting toys for Christmas.
Gino drops me off at a booth he's clearly proud of. Bernadette Stanis is taking photos with fans. She's best known for her role as Thelma on the 70s sitcom Good Times. She's here selling some of her books.
Every time I come, they take pictures, they support my foundation, which is called Remembering the Good Times, the Alzheimer's Foundation, in honor of my mother who had Alzheimer's.
This is her third time appearing at a roundup, and she makes a good point. While the group has African American roots, there are attendees of various races, ages, and genders.
You know, people think that it's a gangy thing, this type of thing, but it's not. They're just like wonderful little groups, you know, ladies, just little old ladies have their own little groups. I mean, they wear the little pinks or whatever they wear, and they have their little bikes. It's too cute. I just love it.
Taking a moment to rest in the shade behind her is a biker I asked to speak with. Cool Metal is from the Washington, D.C. area. He's the president of the mother chapter of the Flaming Knights, founded in Connecticut in 1968. Its founder was into charity. He was dubbed Robin Hood on a motorcycle by the local newspaper. He was busted by the FBI in 1988 for drug-related crimes and later died in prison. Cool Metal got started riding 13 years ago, well after his club's founder was taken down by the FBI. Off the record, Cool Metal explains to me what the configuration of patches on vests and jackets can mean and who to avoid based on that information.
Depending on what their patch says, right? It means a lot.
I can't tell if it's machismo, genuine concern for my well-being, or a mixture of both.
On the record, he tells me, he doesn't often run into media outlets wanting his perspective in the first place.
Well, the thing about it, a lot of your media is not going to come in here.
Yeah.
And I'm shocked you ain't here.
When I ask what ultimately draws him to this life, it's the same answer I hear again and again.
Freedom. Freedom.
As for the best part of this roundup, for Cool Metal, the main event is the journey, the nearly 700 miles of open road it took to get here on his Harley. The roundup will change venues, as it does every year. It's headed to Mississippi for 2019. Other than the messages of charitable giving and camaraderie among bikers, regardless of race and identity, Gino, my gracious chaperone of this year's event, has one last note.
People need to start seeing motorcycles better because they have a right to the road as well. These are the same people that have families just like you.
From the Illinois State Fairgrounds and the 2018 National Bikers Roundup, I'm Rachel Otwell.
That's it for this week. Thanks for being with us for Statewide. Join us again next week at the same time. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois. You can find out more about the stories you heard today at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford.